This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Bassem Youssef, has often been called the John Stewart of Egypt, and his show was known as the Daily Show of the Arab World. The comparison is no coincidence. Youssef modeled his show on the Daily Show. And as a result of his show's success, he's been a guest on The Daily Show. Youssef is a former heart surgeon who was providing medical care to protesters in Tahrir Square during the Arab Spring. After the overthrow of President Hosni Mubarak, Youssef began producing a series of short political satire videos he hosted from his home and put up on YouTube. That web series was so successful, he was offered his own show by the Egyptian network on TV. That's when he gave up medicine. His show became the most popular TV series in Egypt's history. But Mohamed Morsi, who was elected president after Mubarak's fall, didn't appreciate being satirized. In 2013, Youssef was accused of insulting the president and insulting Islam. The prosecutor general issued a warrant for Youssef's arrest. He turned himself in and was interrogated for 6 hours before being released on bail. The incident prompted John Stewart to send this message to President Morsi in an episode of The Daily Show.
But come on! Charging Bassem Youssef with insulting Egypt and Islam? I know Bassem. Bassem is my friend, my brother. There are two things he loves in this world with all his heart, Egypt and Islam. And his family. The three things. There's three. And the, what is that flatbread with the cheese? It's tart. It's like a white. It's not Baba Ghanoush. It's like, there's four things that he loves. My point is, Bassem Youssef loves Egypt so much, he chooses to live there, even though some crazy guy is threatening to arrest him. Oh, right. But by the way, without Bassem and all those journalists and bloggers and brave protesters who took to Tahrir Square to voice dissent, you, President Morsi, would not be in a position to repress them. For someone who spent time in jail yourself, under Mubarak, you seem awfully eager to send other people there for the same non-crimes. And just like you, they will only emerge from prison stronger and more determined. So all sending comedians and bloggers to prison accomplishes is lowering the quality of prison yard athletics.
Youssef's case eventually was dismissed, and he returned to his TV show. But the leaders of the military coup that later pushed out President Morsi didn't like being satirized either. Youssef's show was terminated, and he got out of Egypt. He's been living in Dubai, but right now he's in the States, working on a new series called The Democracy Handbook that will premiere this spring on the Fusion Channel's new digital platform, F Comedy. Youssef spoke with Terry last Wednesday.
Bassem Youssef, welcome to Fresh Air. Is there any kind of tradition of political satire in Egypt? I mean, there's a long tradition of that in the United States. Were you starting something that was, like, kind of brand new in Egypt?
There was always satire in Egypt, but they were always shy away from the head of the state. The people who are in charge were always off limits. So satire is not something I invented in Egypt. It was there. What we did differently was the ceiling that we were breaking and the packaging or how it looked on the screen.
John Stewart's show is pre-recorded, but it's in front of a live audience. And you were the first show in the Middle East or in the Arab world to have a live audience. Was the government afraid of that?
No, at that time, you have to remember, there was like a kind of hope and a window of free speech that so many people were allowed to create and be creative and do what they wanted. So at that time, the people was much stronger, and we dictated what we wanted. Later, of course, things got a little bit different, and the pressures were much stronger. But at that time, no, the government didn't have a say of like what to allow and what not to allow.
So you started your show after the Egyptian revolution that overthrew President Mubarak. And then under President Mohamed Morsi, who was elected after the revolution, he accused you of insulting the government. Wait, I have a list here of the... Well, you probably know it by heart.
You can recite it.
Yeah.
Well, I was accused of insulting the president, insulting Islam, insulting spreading rumors, disturbing the peace. But it was not him, just to be fair. I mean, the way that things happen in Egypt, the government or the head of the government don't get personally involved. There were always goonies and agents and people who do that kind of work for the government, either by direct instructions or because they think that they're doing something good or they want to be on the good side of the government. It is about creating an atmosphere where you hold people or like accuse people of whatever crazy stuff because of what they say. And this is not, it happened during Morsi, before Morsi, after Morsi. It's still continuing. And that was ridiculous because now you're having a joker who's up against the government. And we were always at the risk of being accused of something. I think by the time I left Egypt, there was about like 400 accusations against me in the drawer of the public prosecutor office. It's a way for them to exhaust you, to push you, to put you under pressure, to distract you. And that's a very old style that we are known for in the Middle East.
Were you disappointed that the Arab Spring, the Egyptian Revolution, didn't bring the kind of free speech that it stood in support of? That you still couldn't host a satirical show on television without getting detained and interrogated, which is one of the things that happened to you?
Well, detained and interrogated is like one of the least things that happened. I mean, afterwards, the signal was jammed a couple of times. We were banned a couple of times. I lost my show when I had to leave the country. So yes, the disappointment is big, but like I want to look at the bigger picture. When we overthrew Mubarak, we did this in 18 days. And because we were very naive and very unexperienced in revolutions, we thought that was it. It is very difficult to imagine that you can actually get rid of a dictatorship that has been there for 60 years only in 18 days. So we were very naive. We thought that was it and that we were ready. But it never takes 18 days. It takes decades. And I always tell people that a revolution is not an event, it's a process. It is a struggle, and it doesn't usually go smoothly.
When you were detained and interrogated in Egypt, one of the things they did is play clips from your show and ask you about that. What did they need to know from the clips? I mean, what do they want to know from you? It's like you're not a CIA agent. You don't have access to, like, intelligence. You're a surgeon who became a satirist. So why were they playing you clips? What kind of questions did they ask you?
Well, first of all, about the CIA agent, I have a joke for you about that. But let me tell you first about the interrogation. So because I was facing things like insulting the president, insulting Islam, insulting whatever, they would actually play the clips for me to see if I've actually insulted them. And they would actually play it for me. And they asked me, what did you mean by that? I said, like, well, it's a joke. And I said, like, well, yeah, what did you mean? Are you satirizing the president? It's like, no, I'm just saying it as it is. And it's like, why are the people laughing? It's like, well, you know, you should ask them. And it, the worst thing ever that you have to explain your joke, because I was very disappointed trying to explain why the joke is funny for the interrogator.
Oh, okay.
So he would ask me, why are they laughing? I said, like, well, they are laughing because of this. but let me get back to the CIA thing, because
yes,
this is one of the conspiracy theories that was actually used against me. They actually, people went out there and they wrote articles and went on television shows saying that I am an operative of the CIA who used John Stewart to recruit me. So John Stewart, who actually a guy from America, was used by the CIA in order to recruit me for the CIA and make me a CIA agent, to use sarcasm to bring down the government and bring down the country. Because this is all, of course, part of a worldwide conspiracy against the country.
When you were detained, John Stewart in the U.S. on The Daily Show did kind of a commentary about that, about how he was your friend and he didn't realize he was consorting with a criminal. And he quoted some of the things that Morsi had said about your show, charging you with, you know, insulting the president and insulting Islam. Then he showed a clip of President Morsi telling people to, and these were older clips, telling people to nurse their children on hatred of Zionism, and a clip of Morsi calling Zionists bloodsuckers descended from apes and pigs. So an example of him doing exactly what he charged you with doing, which is insulting religion. As I watched that when it was happening, I was wondering, was that going to help you or hurt you? Because he was clearly expressing his connection with you, his deep friendship with you, and his, you know, solidarity with you. At the same time, if it got back to President Morsi that John Stewart was satirizing Morsi on your behalf, I don't think President Morsi would have liked it very much. So did that have any impact, do you know? And did you think it was a good thing or a bad thing that he was doing
we have to look at this in context. At that time, although the Islamist regime was trying to get its own way, but they were not strong enough to stop a program, or like they tried, but they couldn't because the people were against them. They kind of alienated the people in Egypt, and it was difficult for them to operate through that. So here's like a paradox I'm going to tell you. So when John Stewart came to my defense, the anti-Islamist regime hailed that and you know, said like, this is amazing. You see, like we shouldn't crack down on free speech, and you Islamist guys are like fascists and whatever. When John Stewart came to my defense after Morsi, because I did the same thing with the regime that followed Morsi, the same people who hailed the move from John Stewart, they actually believed in the same conspiracy theories that the Islamists were propagating and said like, oh, you are asking for support from the West and from people who want to bring us down. It was a very, very interesting process to see the same people who stood next to you. Now, because you are criticizing the regime that they support, that they would use the same kind of lies and conspiracy theories that was used by the people against them. And I think that the religious and the military right wings are just two sides of the same coin. Somebody uses God and religion, and somebody uses country and security.
So you've been living in Dubai, right?
Yes, for a year after I left Egypt.
How did you choose Dubai?
Well, it was closer, and the producer of my show, who actually fled Egypt before me because they arrested his father and brother, went to Dubai, so there was already a setup there. So for me, it was a good transitional zone area to be there before I moved to the States.
That's terrifying. They arrested his father and brother, and did seeing that help inspire you to leave?
No, it took me another year, and I continued with my show for another season until I was shut down. I didn't actually leave until they used a court of law in order to get an arbitration case against me. It was a sham verdict, of course. It was strange. It's a little bit complicated. The TV channel that I was hosting my show ended my show, and we went to court, and they actually asked for compensation, and they got it for $15 million. Which is crazy, right? Because they're the one who actually shut down my show. So like when that verdict came out, I knew that they knew that I don't have $15 million. They knew that I can't pay that. So I knew that they will use this in order to ban me from traveling or put me in jail. So I escaped.
You escaped?
Yes, I did.
So you weren't able to just kind of like leave normally? You had to escape?
No, I mean, like, I got on a plane just 4 hours after the verdict because I don't know how that play out.
Right.
And maybe looking back, I think this was the right decision to do.
How nervous were you that you wouldn't make it out?
I was very nervous. And But the minute I landed the other side, I opened Twitter and social media, and the news of the verdict was all over the place. So yeah, maybe we kind of like had a very, very, very like close break.
So I wish you all success. Thank you so much and be well. And thank you so much for doing this interview.
Thank you so much.
Bassem Youssef spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Youssef became known here as the John Stewart of the Arab world after the Egyptian Revolution when he hosted a satirical news show in Egypt inspired by The Daily Show. His new satirical series, The Democracy Handbook, will premiere in the spring on the Fusion Channel's new digital platform. A lot of what you think you know about homegrown jihadists in America may be wrong. Our next guest, Peter Bergen, has been reporting on jihadists who were born in the U.S. or grew up here and how they were radicalized. He's compiled a database of people in the U.S. who have been charged with a jihadist crime to help understand how they were radicalized and how they might have been stopped. He's written a new book called United States of Jihad. It traces the history of how militant Islamic groups came to recruit lone wolves in the U.S. Bergen also describes how the internet and social media have been used to radicalize and recruit Americans, and how some American jihadists became innovators in the jihadi use of digital media. Bergen is CNN's national security analyst and is the author of 4 previous books about terrorism. In 1997, working as a producer for CNN, Bergen produced bin Laden's first TV interview, in which he declared war against the U.S. Terry spoke with Bergen last Tuesday.
Peter Bergen, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Let's
start with an interesting comparison. Compare the number of deaths in the U.S. by militant Muslim terrorists with the number of deaths by right-wing extremists.
Well, since 9/11, the foundation that I work at, New America, we've been compiling deaths caused by jihadi terrorists. And at a certain point, we started thinking, hey, why don't we also, there are anti-government fanatics who also kill people and violent neo-Nazis. And so since 9/11, 45 people have been killed in the United States by jihadi terrorists, while 48 have been killed by people animated by, you know, anti-abortion, neo-Nazi, anti-government fanaticism.
Let's look at another comparison, the number of Islamic extremists who have attacked Americans on American soil, the number who come from other countries and have come here for the attacks versus the number of attackers who are American-born or are American citizens and grew up here.
You know, what's interesting, since 9/11, we tend to think that terrorist attacks against the United States must be conducted by foreigners because on 9/11 it was 19 foreign-born Arab hijackers recruited by al-Qaeda. In fact, every lethal terrorist attack in the United States since 9/11, whether in Fort Hood or Boston or San Bernardino, has been conducted by American citizens or legal permanent residents. And so some of the hysteria about refugees coming into the country and performing acts of terrorism is very overblown. Certainly, about 10 refugees have been involved in relatively minor jihadi terrorism crimes like material support for a terrorist organization. But really, if you're concerned about lethal attacks, it's been American citizens or American residents.
Now, why are these two comparisons that we've discussed important in understanding and addressing the larger problem of Islamic extremism in the U.S.?
Well, I think some of what we've been discussing, Terry, is good news. I mean, if we'd had this conversation in 2002 and you had somebody on your program who predicted it, then a decade and a half after 9/11, that only 45 people would be killed by people animated by Osama bin Laden's ideology, that would have seemed like a wildly optimistic claim. And of course, every one of these thefts is a tragedy, but they aren't national catastrophes on the scale of 9/11 or anything close, or even on the scale of what we saw in Paris, where 130 people were killed. So, I mean, you know, I think terrorism isn't only about numbers, because of course people react to terrorism. Our fears are not entirely rational. But, you know, that said, if you bring some rationality to the problem, terrorism is really a relatively minor issue. And the United States government has done a pretty good job of keeping us safe through a whole variety of measures. Just to give you one example, you know, on 9/11, there were 16 people on the no-fly list. Today, there are 47,000. And there's a much larger list of 1.5 million people that if you got on a flight to the United States, you'd be put into secondary screening because you're deemed to have some kind of even relatively small association with potential association with a terrorist group. So, you know, I think the good news is that we've really managed the threat. We, the United States, and also the American Muslim community, is largely pretty well integrated in a way that is not the case in Europe. If you look at the perpetrators of the Paris attacks in November, or you look at the Charlie Hebdo attack, I mean, these people who perpetrated these attacks grew up in these rather grim banlieue suburbs, which are like the projects, the French projects. Many of them served time in French prisons. One of the most astonishing statistics is less than 10% of the French population is Muslim, yet almost as much as 70% of their prison population is Muslim. So we're looking at a very different problem here in the United States than you're looking at in Europe.
So knowing what you know and having access to this data bank that you created on jihadis in the U.S., what are your impressions of the rhetoric we've been hearing about terrorism and about Muslims coming to America in this presidential campaign?
Well, the rhetoric is massively overblown, which is hardly surprising since it's a presidential campaign season. And the two, you know, and it's interesting if you look at the data on what are the main issues that the electorate is interested in. In December, polling suggested that 24% of Republicans thought that terrorism was the number one issue facing the nation. Only 9% of Democrats felt the same way. But certainly, if you look at also polling data about fears and worries about terrorism, you find that, you know, very large numbers of Americans are concerned about the possibility of another terrorist attack. So, you know, even if those fears are fundamentally, I think, somewhat irrational, I mean, obviously there will be other terrorist attacks going forward, but I mean, nothing on, you know, I'm talking about major terrorist attacks that kill, mass casualty attacks. Those are quite unlikely. So in the political season, where, of course, this has been a big issue, you know, you had Ted Cruz saying that we should bomb Syria, carpet bomb Syria to destroy ISIS, which makes no sense at all since ISIS is closely embedded in the civilian population of major cities in Iraq and Syria. We had Donald Trump, of course, saying we should ban all Muslim immigration. You know, I mean, this is, you know, neither of these responses make any sense.
So the demographics of homegrown terrorism are not what you'd think. They certainly aren't what I would have thought. And you can say this with some authority because you have a database that you're keeping about people who we now know are homegrown terrorists or would-be terrorists. And so, you know, I would have thought that these are people who either came from the kind of background, either because of poverty or because of ethnic heritage, who felt very alienated from American culture and felt that they were shut out and they were angry as a result and wanted to express that anger. Or that they came from extremist families and were brought up that way, but those things just aren't true. Is there a typical profile that you've managed to find? Any pattern that you've found, and why an American-born person would become a jihadi?
Well, you know, that's sort of the big puzzle of the book, and I spent 2.5 years researching it, and I don't claim to have a particularly brilliant answer to the why question, because the more you look at each individual case, the more individual the case becomes. And there's a wonderful quote from the philosopher Immanuel Kant, from the crooked timber of humanity, not a straight thing is made. And I think it's almost the motto for this book, because when you really look at why somebody, you know, decides to kill a number of his fellow American citizens, and of course the perpetrators are usually he's, it often becomes a very complicated answer to that question. It's not, you know, yes, there is some sort of bin Ladenist ideology in there, but often there's personal disappointments, a desire for recognition, seeking to belong to something, seeking a cause. But of this we looked at 300 cases plus of Americans convicted since 9/11 of some kind of jihadi terrorism crime, ranging from the relatively minor to the major, such as murder. And the profile we found, average age 29, a third married, a third kids, as educated as normal Americans, mental problems actually at a lower incidence than the general population. And so you're looking at middle class, these are not young hotheads of the popular imagination. They're, you're looking at kind of middle class, married, you know, late 20s. And in fact, when we came to that conclusion, we didn't know that the San Bernardino attackers, one of them is 27, one is 28. They were married. They had a child. The male perpetrator had a job earning $70,000 a year. They were very much solidly part of the American middle class. And so why did they turn to violence and kill 14 people just arbitrarily? You know, that's a really big puzzle. I mean, you could try and explain it by they were influenced by Al-Qaeda's ideology and ISIS's ideology, that they objected to American foreign policy. But lots of people object to American foreign policy and don't go and just arbitrarily kill 14 people attending a Christmas office party. At the end of the day, that's fundamentally, I think, inexplicable. And it may get to the nature of evil itself, which is it's often pointless and often inexplicable.
So in your book, you profile several people who, you know, who are Americans and became, or at least tried to become, jihadis. One of them is an Alabama native named Omar Hamami.
Yeah.
And he became a leader of Al-Shabaab, which is the Somali branch of the jihadis. And then he became a target of Al-Shabaab. And several things that are really interesting about this story. One is that his wife is Somali, and she refused to go with him. I mean, her parents were Somali refugees, and like she's like, I'm not going back. I'm not going to Somalia. I know what it's right. like there. So he just leaves his family behind and tries to go and succeeds in going. And you have a photo of him with a deputy leader of Al-Shabaab during a press conference in 2011 in Mogadishu. And you have a photo from 1999 of him on a high school date. And it looks like one of those studio photographs where everybody gets to be in the same backdrop. He's wearing white pants and a blue blazer. She's wearing a corsage on her wrist. Mm. Looks like it's
and
maybe
she's
a prom she's photo
one of the,
or something.
Yeah, it is a prom photo. And she was one of the most attractive, popular girls in the class. And he was also one of the cool guys until he converted to Islam. You can imagine converting to Islam and making a very public show of it in rural Alabama, particularly after 9/11, but even before that. And Omar Hamami was a very bright kid. And he and another very bright kid, his best friend, Bernie Calvihouse, they both went down this road of radicalization. And what's fascinating is they're both the same age. They both got married to Somali women in Canada. They then moved from Canada to Egypt. And they did everything together for years, and they radicalized together. But Bernie Calvihouse, when the moment came to go to Somalia, said, no, you know what? I have a wife and kid. I'm going to go back. And now he works in Silicon Valley, and he's got, three kids, and he's living a very, normal life. Omar Hamami went to Somalia, became a leader of Shabaab, got involved in some kind of dispute with them about their tactics, and ended up being assassinated by Shabaab. And it gets back to this why question. To go to Somalia, it's the most dangerous, at the time that Omar made this decision, it was the most dangerous country in the world.
And then he basically picks a fight with Al-Shabaab's leaders. He's criticizing them on social media, which is a dangerous thing to do. And they shoot him, and he live tweets his own shooting. Do you want to read a couple of those posts from your book?
Oh, sure. So this is what I describe in the book is probably the first live tweeting of an assassination attempt in history. And Omar Hamami, who tweets as Abu American, first tweet says, just been shot in neck by Shabaab assassin, not critical yet. Second tweet says, sitting in tea place, then three shots behind to left, pistol, I think, they ran. And then finally, no windpipe or artery, peroxide, gauze, and pressure, a perimeter has been made. And then a little bit later in the day, they're sending forces from multiple directions. We are few, but we might get back up. Abu Zubair, who's the head of Shabaab, has gone mad. He's starting a civil war. And then finally, after the failed assassination attempt, I woke in the morning to hear that I was surrounded. We ran to a hole behind the house and waited. And shortly thereafter, Shabaab killed him.
That's amazing, live tweeting your own assassination.
It really is.
I mean, if you want to talk about social media and jihad, that's just so...
Terry, one of the interesting things about this book is that this was the first book I had where social... a lot of these people that I wanted to interview are either dead or in prison. And social media, of course, is a tremendous boon for me as a reporter because, it allows... Omar tweeted like 1,700 times before he died. He also published a 127-page biography on the web. And both of those were vital to get inside his head. I couldn't talk to him. I did speak to his family, to his father. But social media has been a real boon for this kind of reporting project because it allows you to kind of get, to some degree, a real-time sense of what somebody's like.
Well, Peter Bergen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, Terry, thank you very much.
Peter Bergen's new book is United States of Jihad. He spoke with Terry last Tuesday. Why we love the foods we love and are repulsed by certain foods we hate is what Bea Wilson tries to explain in her new book, First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. She writes from her perspective as a food writer, as a mother who tried to get her three children to eat healthy foods, and as someone who came close to having an eating disorder. In her book, she examines studies about how genetics, culture, memory, and early feeding patterns contribute to our food preferences. She's particularly interested in the eating habits of children. She writes, quote, when your beautiful baby is first handed to you by the doctor or midwife, and you see a whole future in those blurry eyes, It's unlikely you'd imagine that he or she might become a person who ate only ketchup sandwiches, Oreos, and instant noodles, unquote. Wilson also is the author of Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat. Wilson spoke with Terry last Thursday.
B. Wilson, welcome to Fresh Air. So part of what your book is about is how our tastes are formed, like our taste preferences, why we like sweet things, why we like or don't like bitter things. So before we get into some of the more behavioral things like eating disorders, let's talk a little bit just about how our palate is formed. Like, is it formed as early as when we're being milk-fed, you know, from the bottle or from the breast?
It's formed earlier than that. It's formed when our mothers are expecting us. There have been remarkable studies done showing that if someone eats a lot of garlic when they're pregnant, their amniotic fluid will taste and smell garlicky. So imagine swimming around in that for 9 months. There have also been studies done
Let me stop you there. Does that mean that baby will grow up to like or to hate garlic?
That baby will grow up to love garlic.
It feels like home.
It feels like home. It tastes like home. One of the main things we know about taste is that liking is a consequence of familiarity. So the things that our mothers eat, even before we're born, affect the way we'll respond to those flavours when we later encounter them, because they seem familiar. So, and then to follow on from your question about milk, yes, the flavour of milk is then hugely important as well. With mothers who breastfeed, there was a study done showing that if they drank a lot of carrot juice, when those babies first tasted solid food, they preferred cereal that was flavoured with carrot juice.
If the mothers, while breastfeeding, drank carrot juice?
Yes, so the flavour of carrots goes into the milk, the babies experience it, and then they have all of these wonderful positive feelings about carrot. And this is getting replicated many, many times, but in most cases, it's not something like carrot or broccoli. There have been studies done with rats who are fed on a junk food diet, and their babies gravitate towards junk food rat chow. And that's the reality for many of us, that the foods we most associate with love and home and familiarity are industrialized, sugary, fatty, salty ones. And those are all bound up with these wonderful feelings of love and home. And it's really hard to break those habits.
So what do you know about the differences between breast milk and formula in terms of like sweetness and how it might shape the taste preferences of a baby as they mature and graduate into solid food?
Well, the single biggest thing we know is that breast milk has varied flavours, whereas formula milk has a single flavour, depending on which brand you pick. But even with formula-fed babies, there are some interesting things that have come out of scientific experiments. There's a type of formula called hydrolysate, which is designed for babies who can't tolerate regular cow's milk. To adults, it has a really offensive, horrible, hay-like, musty aroma. But to the babies who've been reared on it, it's like nectar. And one study showed that these children, when they were older, when they were aged 4, gravitated towards sour flavours. So it was as if they were imprinted with the flavour of this nasty formula milk. But again, it's a really useful case of how powerful these early tastes can be. As parents, we have a far greater power than we think we have to form children's tastes.
Are children, young children, hardwired to prefer certain flavors?
Yes and no. All human beings are hardwired to love sweetness. This is a cross-cultural phenomenon. It's been seen in babies in every continent of the world, that they smile if you offer them a little taste of something sweet. Equally, we all are born with a mild aversion to bitterness. And curiously, with salt, we have no feelings at all about salt when we're born, and then aged 4 months, we get switched onto it and develop a salt preference, and nobody really knows why that's true. So we're hardwired to love sweetness. Many people have interpreted this to mean that we're doomed to grow up and love junk food. It must mean that we're hardwired for cupcakes. Not so. All of our specific tastes for particular flavours are learned. As omnivores, this has to be the case, because human beings are forced to eat in such different food environments. So the fact that we love sweetness as a baby doesn't mean that we're going to love nothing but chocolate. We could get that sweetness in the form of a corn on the cob or caramelized fennel. All of our flavor preferences are ones that we learn over the course of a lifetime.
I want to go back for a second to what you said about babies in the womb being able to taste the amniotic fluid and have a taste for instance, garlic, which can end up in the amniotic fluid if the mother is eating a lot of garlic. And that garlic will be like home, will be like real comfort food as that baby matures. To explain that, like the fetus has taste buds, like the taste buds form at 7 or 8 weeks of gestation. Mm. And you say they're mature by 13 to 15 weeks. I guess I never would have thought about taste buds being mature at that stage of gestation because it's not like there's any eating going on.
I never would have thought that either. And the more research I did into the neuroscience of flavor, the more I came across this understanding that actually tasting food, flavor is one of the main ways that we interact with the world from before we're born and certainly after we're born. Our olfactory system is open to the world through the nose in the way that no other part of our central nervous system is. Encountering flavors is just a fundamental part of what it is to be human.
So are there times that are the best times to introduce new flavors to a baby?
There are. There has been interesting research done showing that there is this thing called a flavor window between 4 and 7 months when humans are more receptive to new flavors than they will ever be again. Researchers I've spoken to into the question of how you get children to be less picky eaters, how you get them to try more different vegetables, say that the World Health Organization advice, which currently says you should keep them on an exclusive milk diet up to 6 months, is wrong. It's not that a child necessarily needs any nutrition beside milk before 6 months. It's that you're missing an opportunity to introduce them to all of these flavors, which they would likely accept at this age. And then having accepted them, they would seem familiar when they encounter them again as toddlers. But having said that there's a flavor window at this age, it's not that the flavor window then flips shut and we become closed off and we can never learn to love bitter green vegetables. Humans can learn to love new flavors at any age. One of the amazing things about our relationship with food is how malleable it is, how plastic it is. But we don't usually, as adults, give ourselves an opportunity to change.
Why do you think it is that so many children have food aversions and also weird food preferences?
There are a few different reasons. I mean, some of it does have a genetic component. More than 70% of children on the autistic spectrum suffer with some kind of feeding disorder. But the larger part of these feeding problems that so many children seem to have, these limited tastes, this refusal of all vegetables, this suspicion of mixed up flavors, has to do with our food environment, both within families and within our larger culture, where children are given so many messages which suggest that they shouldn't like vegetables, that they're something that's healthy and therefore unpleasant. And they pick up on these cues from everything they see around them, whether it's adverts or whether they see the ways that the adults and their family themselves relate to food.
You write about your husband who has a food aversion to rice pudding because he was forced to eat it when he was a child. And he'll sometimes like leave the table if you're serving rice pudding. And that's a hard one for me to understand. I understand some food aversions, but rice pudding seems kind of tame and it's like nice and sweet. And, you know, what's wrong with rice? So do you comprehend it?
I find it very hard to understand, too, because to me, rice pudding is one of the most delicious substances you can imagine. But I think a lot of people have it, especially in Britain, because rice pudding was a school food and therefore it was eaten in an atmosphere of coercion. He also just says it's the texture. But then I say to him, you love risotto. It's the same texture. And then he'll say it's completely different. And it isn't just he leaves the table. He leaves the room. He doesn't want to watch us eating. He doesn't want to hear us swallowing it. Anyone's food aversion could be like this. Someone else's preferences are always mysterious. You think, well, how can you not like that? It's perfectly delicious. But to the person who finds it disgusting, it's so offensive they don't want to put it in their mouth. I've spoken to directors of feeding clinics who say that some children have aversion so profound that if they know that someone is entering the room carrying a plate of food that they haven't tried, they will spontaneously gag or vomit before they've even seen the food. And it's the idea of the food. I mean, so many of these things which we think are physical or rational, they're not. It's profoundly emotional, the way we eat. We all bring emotions to the dinner table.
Do you have any food aversions?
I have a few. I'm fairly omnivorous. That was never my real problem with eating. My problems were more with stopping. But if you were to serve me a soft-boiled egg and the white was stringy and gelatinous and just too soft, I would probably still eat it out of politeness, but something inside me would die.
I have a weird food aversion to oranges.
And really?
Yes, and the orange is just like worshipped. Like there are orange juice commercials where it's raining orange juice from the sky as if that was a wonderful thing. I went to like a train station, and I think this was actually, I think it was in Canada, actually, and there was a pavilion in there where you buy your tickets or something. I don't remember it that clearly. That was shaped like an orange, and your plate of food at a restaurant is garnished with oranges, and people just assume that, like, the oranges is like the most wonderful thing in the world. And I think the reason maybe why they terrify me is that when I was in school, there wasn't really a lunchroom. So, like, if you had to eat lunch because there was, like, a blizzard or something, if you had to eat in the school, you basically, like, sat on a bench in the basement next to the bathroom. And the kids would always have, like, oranges packed in their lunch bag. And I think, like, the smell of, like, peeling oranges and, like, the smell of that basement just kind of mingled in my mind.
So maybe it mingled with other musty, unpleasant aromas. So somehow it was associated with rottenness or something. I mean, people have tried to unravel what makes someone dislike something. And often nausea is at the root of it in some form. Maybe that room made you feel slightly sick. It's hard to say, isn't it? My niece has this as well. She hates orange juice.
And really?
She won't even let my sister,
you should get
mom
together.
Yeah, form a club. Yeah, orange juice haters unite. It is it's a very strong flavour, isn't it? I mean, I love it. I can't imagine not loving it. But I know what you mean about the peel. When you peel an orange, it fills the whole room.
Yeah, exactly. So you read that the people who study this stuff say that the best style of feeding is called authoritative feeding. What is that?
Yes. So the simple way to describe it would be an authoritative feeder would place high demands on the child to eat well. In other words, you wouldn't be stocking your house with loads of junk food. You'd make sure there were nutritious, good home-cooked meals on the table. But equally, you would be highly responsive to the child and their needs, and you would be respectful when they say no. And the styles of parenting which seem to have worse results in the way that you feed a child are at the opposite ends of the extreme. On the one hand, there are authoritarian forms of feeding. Force feeding would be an extreme example, but also just any form of saying, I demand that you eat this.
You're not leaving the table until you finish your vegetables.
Exactly. I want a clean plate. That old mentality that you hate waste so much that you're going to see a child finish what's on their plate, regardless of whether they like it or not. That style of feeding, well, A, we know it makes children unhappy, which isn't nice. It creates an unpleasant atmosphere at the dinner table. But interestingly, research shows it also seems to result in children who are actually less responsive to their own hunger cues. So they're more likely to end up overweight. Paradoxically, the parent who thinks that they're doing the right thing by insisting that you finish this nourishing meal is not allowing the child to develop their own skills, their own judgment about when they stop and when they start eating. But the other style of parenting or feeding would be indulgent. And there are signs that this is becoming one of the most common ways of feeding a child. And as with so much of what we do as parents, it comes with the most loving intentions. I mean, to feed a child in an indulgent way would be to be highly responsive to them as a person, what they love, what they seem to need, the foods that they crave, the foods they demand. But the indulgent style would place no demands on them to eat well, or fewer demands. There would be no sense of, are you really hungry? There would be no sense of, well, I only want you to have these foods because they're the ones that will do you good. And again, there are studies done showing indulgent parenting is strongly correlated with higher child obesity.
And do you think a lot of parents feed their children certain things because they think that their children will love them more for it if they give them like sweet things or whatever it is that the child loves most?
Absolutely. I'm sure we all do that as parents to some extent, because it's such a wonderful feeling to see the treat disappear and to see the happy face. Feeding no less than eating is a learnt behaviour, and we learn to feed through our parents, who probably themselves rewarded us with food. I mean, it's food and love are so bound up, it's sometimes hard to see where the sugar ends and the love begins.
That's why you're right. There's a difference between feeding disorders and eating disorders.
Yes. So feeding disorders would generally be categorized as those which you see in very young kids, things like eating only ketchup sandwiches or hot dogs. Or there'd be other ones such as pica, where children gravitate towards eating really strange, inedible things such as grass or paper or dirt. And then the eating disorders are things like anorexia or bulimia, which are classically seen in older children. But actually, the more you look into it, the more you see these distinctions break down, because there is a real hidden problem of adult picky eaters who still will only eat a very limited range of foods, maybe no vegetables and maybe nothing much except for grilled cheese sandwiches and hot dogs and potato chips. And it's a terrible way to live, but often the adult picky eaters will keep their problem very well hidden because there's so much shame attached to eating like that. They may refuse invitations to go and eat at friends' houses.
Bea Wilson, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bea Wilson's new book is First Bite, How We Learn to Eat. She spoke with Terry last Thursday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challenger. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.B. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inkuli.